This is our third installment of Dig Deep on political parties. We've been talking history so far. Chuck Marone's our conservative commentator. Aaron Brown is our liberal commentator. Chuck, where do we begin now?
So this fascinating thing started to happen in the 1960s, and that is that we became a very mobile population. And what you see starting in the presidential election in 64, on forward, is you see the parties becoming not only realigned, Democrats and Republicans kind of flipping, the Republicans becoming the party of the South over time, the Democrats becoming the party now of urban areas, Republicans the party of rural areas. But what you see is this purification of the parties. So where, you know, precincts used to be 55-45 right or 55-45 left, they've now become more pure versions of whatever ideology they are. So you have some districts in this country today where Republicans win 80% of the vote. There's not even contested. You have some districts where Democrats win 80% of the vote. Republicans don't even put a candidate on the ballot. They have no chance. How did this happen? Essentially, because we have become so mobile, what you see is that instead of people staying put in place, yeah, here's where I was born, maybe I, you know, a few of us go away to college, but most of us stay put. We now encourage people to move, not only to go away to school, but often to go find different job opportunities. And what happens, a guy named Bill Bishop wrote a great book about this called The Big Sort. We talked about how if you move to a new city, and he moved to Austin, Texas. So he described his trip to Austin, which Austin is a very blue city in a very red state. He said his realtor brought him around and showed him a bunch of homes. And the first homes that he looked at, you know, there were pickups in the driveways and gun racks in the back and the houses were kind of separated from each other and had big setbacks and big garages. And he's like, you know, this just doesn't feel like my kind of neighborhood. Then they took him over to a different neighborhood and the cars were kind of small. And this was in the early 2000s. There was no blood for oil signs in the front yard. And the bumper stickers on the cars were like different, you know. And he's kind of like, you know, this feels more like my neighborhood. He didn't consciously set out to live amongst a bunch of liberals. But he did, because that was the kind of lifestyle that appealed to him when he's looking for a home. What you see is that on a grand scale, on a nationwide level, what we have done is we have self-sorted into ideological bubbles. We've self-sorted into ideological communities where everybody around us thinks very similar to us. And one of the big problems with this, and we see this kind of manifested in our politics today, is that what is a normal or average viewpoint becomes skewed either way to the right or way to the left. And what is an extreme viewpoint, you know, if you're very right of center and you live in a community of very right of center people, a moderate left viewpoint will seem very extreme to you, will seem way out there. And a very extreme right viewpoint will seem kind of close to home. You get the same thing on the left. And so what we have is we have two groups of people. Every election, we see it getting more and more refined, more and more honed, where now our two political parties are purely geographically aligned, and each voting district has become more and more purified along those lines, to where you can almost sit and predict right now who will win the House in the next election, who will win. And we live in like one of the very few districts in the country that's unclear in that standpoint.
And that's, I think, because our district is realigning much as you describe. So we're in the 8th district of Northern Minnesota as we speak today, right now. And it's, like Chuck said, arguably one of the most competitive districts, most expensive spending districts for congressional races in the country.
I think it's one of three in the country
that
is rural, represented by a Democrat.
Right. It's one of the only three left. And the other two are also in Minnesota.
Which, oh, really? I didn't know.
Yeah, Walz's district and Peterson's district. So we live in a state where, like, Minnesota has a unique tradition. I think it's manifested in the fact that there is still a rural Democratic party here. But it's threatened, and it's waning, you could argue, as we watch what happened here in the 8th District. For 30 plus years, 36 years, Jim Oberstar represented Northeastern Minnesota in Congress. He was a kind of a classic Democratic congressman from a district that loved meat and potatoes and labor. And he was elected by enormous, unfathomable margins for many, many years. We would laugh when the Republican Party would announce their candidate for the year. People would laugh at them just because of the spectacle of running against Jim Oberstar. In 2010, which was a big Republican year nationally, a wave, the Tea Party wave of conservative, you know, a very radically conservative viewpoint in the historical sense, kind of took hold. And lo and behold, really out of nowhere, and only in the later weeks of the campaign, did Oberstar's own campaign realize there was trouble. And even that was probably not as bad as that the actual thing turned out. Oberstar loses to Chip Kravac. And what I'd call is a pretty affable, likable kind of figure who didn't have to take a lot of strong positions in the campaign, but who was part of the Tea Party conservative movement at the time, and also represented the change of the demographics of the district and how the district had grown to include so much more of a fast-growing southern exurban section of the state of Minnesota, as opposed to the blue-collar Iron Range Duluth roots of the district. Chuck mentioned the Big Sort, the Great Sort.
Yeah, the Big Sort.
The Big Sort. And I would point out, this is what I always say when you ask, people ask, what happened to make the range so conservative? And sometimes people will say, oh, they must have changed their minds. And what I say is, the demographics of the range have changed very consistently over the last 30 years. The population has dropped. It's gotten older. And that's not because people get older, but because there are fewer young people living there. And I always point out that, yeah, lots of Iron Rangers voted for Democrats in the last few elections. Lots of them. The only problem is they live in Keith Ellison's district down in Minneapolis.
Right, right.
And the issue is that as you pick where you want to live, liberal voters, liberal people, and I mean small L, not partisan like they want to run the government, but just people who are liberal.
People who have a disposition that's left of center.
Correct. Are looking into careers, are looking into lifestyles and things they want to do with their life, and coming to the conclusion that living in a small town in northeastern Minnesota isn't going to provide them the things they want to do. So as people do, as people can, because you can get in a metal vehicle that takes you far, far away anytime you want, they go to the Twin Cities and they see the cultural life and things they want to do there. And they actually, and I was one of them. I'm a liberal from the range who looked at the Twin Cities as the beacon of light, and I wanted to go there and be that person. Long story why I'm not there, but I'm glad I'm not there, but anyway, point is, a lot of people did go there. And who stays behind? Is it just the failures who stay behind?
Yeah, it's you and me.
Yeah, Chuck and me. But it's not the failures. It's the people who view the idea of staying in a small community, knowing your neighbors, having the traditional activities of hunting and fishing and being outdoors and these kinds of activities, which I'm not saying liberals don't do
no,
them.
No, but they're people whose disposition tends to be more conservative.
Right, peoples with a conservative right. disposition would choose that lifestyle and make it their number one priority to live that lifestyle, even if they could leave and get jobs elsewhere. So what you see is in rural places in Minnesota, but everywhere, people who are liberal, some of them stay for family I really, practically speaking, stayed for family reasons. And ultimately, I grew to love the community and understand it in different ways. But for the most part, people who are motivated by family, not all of them, but a lot of them, end up thinking in a conservative sort of way.
Or their church connections.
Or their church connections. Right. Or the idea of having like a family church. It's not that you can't be, you know, I'm not trying to say you have to be one or the other. The point is that more people who think that way are conservative. And they end up communicating with each other. And so it's not that the range people changed their mind. Like, I sure loved that John Kerry, and now I don't like that Barack Obama. It's that the people who would have voted for Kerry in 2004 are less likely to live there than
they're part
before.
Of the Big Sort.
Yeah,
and the thing is, a lot of what's keeping the 8th District blue are urban liberals who have second homes who have now moved up here in their retirement
and
years.
Duluth, which has become a very liberal city.
Duluth, right, which is an urban center reflecting urban centers around the country. One of the things that I think is fascinating about today where we're at, and we kind of skipped over this history a little bit, in the mid-70s after Watergate, Minnesota Republican Party became the independent Republican mm-hmm. Party. We like said, we're not part of the national party. We are our own independent Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Don't think of us in the same way. And truly, I think there's this great, if you were to write a book about American politics, it would start with Virginia, but there would be a big chapter about Minnesota's contribution as this kind of outlier of thought and mm-hmm. ideas on both the Republican and the Democratic side. But after the 1994 wave of Republicans, this state said, the Republican Party in this state said, we're dropping the independent. We're no longer the independent Republicans. We're now Republicans, right mm-hmm. in line with the national party. And they did that not because they all of a sudden changed what they believed in. They did it because it was really good for business. Because if you had the Contract for America and basically nationalized these parties and nationalized our local dialogue so that no longer are the people at the barbershop talking about, you know, what are we going to do on this street and what's going on with this mining operation and what, you know, what's going on over here. That what they're talking about now is like, you know, what's going on at the administration at the federal level? What's this diversity policy? What's this EPA rule? What's mm-hmm.
Was in the email blast that
whatever
morning.
So by nationalizing things, both parties have seen benefit from tapping into this self-sorted demographic we now have and this really refinement. And I say that I don't mean refinement as in improvement. I mean refinement as in like distilling down to its essence. So you have a refined product that you make. It's pure. What we've done is we've refined our district so they're nearly pure Republican, nearly pure Democrat. And we've done that voluntarily.
And it makes it so that the only true way to change the balance of power is the census and the redistricting that right. occurs as people move and make those choices. The problem is that's a glacial pace for the political environment.
You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE, KBXE. That's Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. We also have Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator. The topic is political parties and how we have self-sorted. They've been talking about a book by Bill Bishop, The Big Sort. Chuck continues the conversation.
People lament. We just can't talk to each other anymore. We can't seem to get anything done in Washington. What we have is, I think in many ways, with the two-party system, which we have a winner-take-all system at the federal level, we have done two things. One, I think, pushed by Democrats, and I think one pushed by modern Republicans. With the Democrats, we have centralized nearly every major decision we make. So your healthcare decisions are more affected by Washington, D.C. now than something that happens here locally. Road spending, education, all this stuff we've centralized because Democratic ideals say, like, here's how we get things done in a just, fair country. For Republicans, we have also, in a sense, defined the issues in this kind of winner-take-all way. And conservative philosophy in general is to oppose change. And when you have empowered such a large part of the country to oppose all change everywhere, and the other side of the party is like, we want massive radical change on all fronts. You just have a position where there's no liberal Republicans. There's no conservative Democrats. There's nobody to bridge any of those gaps. And I quite frankly don't see how this is resolved until Democrats agree to essentially like localize things more and accept a little bit more chaos. And Republicans can kind of find a way to go along with that, which they're very reluctant to empower, say, cities and others to make local decisions.
We also see some of the realignment in the national parties happening locally as well. I just see it in the local, for instance, DFL party. Growing up as I did on the range and being politically active and being a liberal meant you licked envelopes and did things with the DFL party. That was, for the time I grew up, the party. And so if you wanted to get involved, that's what you did. And for the DFL party, just looking back at my experiences as a volunteer, as a campaign manager later, something like the steelworkers, the union, was a titanic force in the party coalition. Not only did they deliver a lot of votes, there were more steelworkers then who could vote and would almost exclusively vote for the Democratic candidate. But they were the organizational and, to a smaller extent, the financial backers of a lot of party activities. That has changed quite a bit. Just with one example, the steelworkers, which still endorse Democrats nationally and locally because they support pro-labor policies in terms of what unions want. But rank-and-file members of the steelworkers union and rank-and-file members of the Teamsters union here in Grand Rapids or other unions around northeastern Minnesota, they're still probably leaning Democratic, but not nearly as much. And in fact, I'd love to see a printout if there was, it's not possible, but I'd love to know how they voted in the 2016 presidential election, because I'm pretty confident that at least half the steelworkers voted for Trump.
I would estimate that that is very, very true. I think the union, the kind of union block that you had up here has changed. And I think on the national level, the union conversation has changed. I mean, we talked about this in a prior episode, how really the Democrat Party union support is largely professional unions, which the workers out in the mines would call the elitists, right? The college professors, etc.
Educated elite.
Right. The workers unions, if we want to call them that, tend to be now more, I mean, you've got Trump standing up and appointing people to the EPA that are going to help get their jobs back, etc.
That's certainly part of it. But there's also the fact that these contracts that unions have now, especially private unions, these contracts are very mature. That is to say, they've been around a long time. They have all of these provisions that people now count on as part of their compensation, part of their life. And these jobs have become, because there's, you know, there's a fourth of as many miners as there used to be, but they're paid twice or three times as much. And so as a result, a miner in northern Minnesota becomes the middle to upper middle class of the region. They are part of a union that protects that, so they support the union, but they also are of a financial and demographic component of the society that might be open, isn't as open to talking about making it equal for people who don't make much money. That's less important than surviving and providing for their family. And they look at that. And so some of these conservative arguments or Republican Party arguments, some of the things Donald Trump said, it's populist, but kind of ensconced in the conservative kind of philosophy, started to appeal to these people in these mature contracts. And so the great unwashed masses of the old Democratic Party, the poor people, the poor working people, are not organized in unions. And frankly, as of this day right now, don't have a political party.
I would say that they're the ones up for grabs right now, because the Democratic Party is becoming more of, I don't say this in a partisan way, but more of a party of the educated, the elite in this country, the ones who, in a sense, are upper middle class, with the idea that
the exception being
we care about the poor,
that the extremely wealthy are still Republicans.
The 1% are still Republicans. And, you know, I think you have this, I'll go back to the example I've used before. The person standing behind the counter at the Holiday gas station, who represents them? They're not in a union. The Democratic Party really doesn't speak to them except in kind of a patronizing way today. And the Republicans talk a lot of platitudes, but I don't really know as their policies really help them
And issues like healthcare, you would normally say that worker would benefit from a discussion about the minimum wage or improving their wages. They would benefit from a discussion about how they provide healthcare to their family. And Democrats have talked about these things and have accomplished some of these things in a limited way. But it's kind of funny talking to the working poor that I know. I'm related to a good number of them. You know, things like the Affordable Health Care Act, the Affordable Care Act, which I think I sit here today and broadly say that it did some things that needed to happen. But for a lot of the workers in that situation, all they saw was the mandate.
All of a sudden, I got to pay money.
I got to pay money I didn't before. And yeah, they didn't have health care. And you could say, make the intellectual argument that if we have all these people without any health care, when they do have problems, it costs more money, it creates all these problems. That's an intellectual argument. And that makes, therefore, the argument to be intellectuals versus non-intellectuals, which is really frustrating because it's like two people playing a different sport.
Right.
You know, and I don't mean that anti-intellectuals are dumb. What I mean is whether or not you subscribe to this grand notion or whether you subscribe to this notion of simplicity in things. Well, why should I have to pay that? Let's just not pay that. Never mind your arguments why I should. So you have this going on. So that person, and again, not to pick on the gas station people, they're a very diverse lot, believe me. They believe a lot of different things for a lot of different reasons. But in a previous time, that person would have had an ideology or would have been represented by a party. The downtown business person would have been represented by a party, and it would have been dang clear who was their party.
The person who cleans hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. These people have no home today. And mm-hmm. I think the fascinating thing in the next few election cycles will be, where do these people end up? Because they exist in cities, they exist in small towns, they exist in rural areas. They are like the one crossover demographic. They don't agree culturally on things, so they're culturally conservative, culturally liberal, but economically they're adrift. And they're the ones who, I think, if we're going to get serious about what is going to be the party, I think we're going to end up in this country with a party of the privileged, let's say, and you know, the moneyed, the people who have opportunity in front of them, and the party of the downtrodden, which is really the way our political parties have kind of always aligned to a degree. Mm-hmm. I don't know today which party will be which. If you listen to Trump's rhetoric, if you listen to President Trump and his rhetoric, he wants to be the latter, the party of the downtrodden. If you look and listen to the Republicans in Congress, they want nothing to do with that kind of populism. They think that mm-hmm. would be horrible. You also have this problem where, you know, Trump's embrace of the downtrodden is the downtrodden Americans, not the downtrodden immigrants, and even to a degree, not the downtrodden maybe second or third generation Americans, but, you know, Americans
or minority groups or anything.
Right, yeah, right. So there's a nuance there mm-hmm. that is not simple to navigate either. Here's the reason why I continue to come up to Grand Rapids and do this program with my friend Aaron. I think that the biggest challenge we face is that we have lost the ability to speak with each other because we have self-sorted into ideological bubbles where we are never confronted with an opposing point of view from a person who is human to us. They're always an evil enemy. They're always someone we don't relate to. But you know, everybody here sitting at this table has the uncle that is a nut job politically who they don't agree with, mm-hmm. or the, you know, the weird aunt who has these like odd beliefs, but you love her and you love him and you try your best to like understand them and say, you know, uncle, whatever, but if that person, you don't know them, now they're evil. Now mm-hmm. they're horrible. Now they're to be destroyed and beat down.
And one of the things that I struggle with is watching as that dynamic, because that was always true in my family. We're not I'm aligned with the Democratic Party, perhaps, but that's not universal through my family and has never been universally true. There have been a variety of political viewpoints on either side of my family. And it was always, as Chuck described, as long as you humanized them, they were human and their views were simply something that was part of them. It wasn't the definition of them. But I think something's happening with social media and with the, as you mentioned earlier, the radicalization of the parties moving in towards the partisan directions. Like, I have to admit, I love every one of my cousins and relatives. But when I see a meme shared that I find just so crass and dehumanizing of human beings, and it's someone I love that shared it, it's a complicated feeling.
It's very hard.
Yeah.
And thing that is different, and I guess maybe this is a good place to end this. I think we used to get our contrary opinions from people we loved, or at least people that we knew in our community mm-hmm. and had a certain level of just inherent respect for. We went to the same church with them. Mm-hmm. Our community,
the post office.
I brought my car to this guy and he might, you know, be a crazy liberal, but I respected him because I had to talk to him and I had to be, you know, I had to go to school with his kids and what have you. Now, because we have refined our cities, our places where we live, the communities we live in, so along ideological lines through this self-sort mechanism, you're only getting your contrary opinions through the MSNBC Fox News filter, the social media filter, the like crazy. And I think this benefits the national parties. I think they like that because mm-hmm. I think it allows them to mobilize their base mm-hmm. and get out to vote and raise more money. I think it's really bad for us as humans. And I think it's really bad for us as a country. So we gotta, like, I'm gonna give Aaron a hug now. We gotta, like, we gotta talk to each other, right?
Right. Just, well, and that's what people who listen to Dig Deep have said. They appreciate thoughtful conversation. You're here to kind of listen to each other as well as talk.
I come here trying to find ways we can agree on things. There's certainly things that we don't agree on. In fact, let's. What I would love to do is do a podcast-only segment where we could just yell at each other.
Yeah, I'm
just get into like the meat of it, you know?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dig Deep. Any last comments?
No, Chuck took us home. And I, you know, the idea here is not that we create a magical solution that everybody should embrace, but rather that we stake out the real things at stake in these issues and identify the arena in which we can meet and talk to. Maybe arena is the wrong choice. That's more gladiator-like. the conference, the hotel conference boardroom where we can comfortably sit and talk to each other, because I think a lot of times we are screaming at each other about things that aren't really important, and that we would find agreement on things that are important. That's just my experience.
Who would win in the gladiator showdown of the two of
between
you?
Chuck and I?
Ooh. You saw my load of wood that I stacked yesterday, yeah. So I think I got the upper hand right now.
Well, I was going to be magnanimous and say that it would be,
but now you don't
I
have
don't
to.
Know who would win, but it would be a very ridiculous
fight.
Yeah,
it fight. Would be ridiculous.
I will say that my dad taught me something important when I was a young man. Now, just a picture of my dad. He said he was a wiry guy. He was about my height, but wiry, and I'm not wiry for those of you sitting at home. So he told me, here's what you do. This is like in middle school. Yeah. Here's what you do. I don't care who it is. I don't care how big they are, how strong they are, how good they are at fighting. Here's what you do. You get them on the ground. You get them on the ground and you hit their head. Hit their head on the curb. You hit their head on a table, on a chair.
This is growing up on the farm. Yeah. I got the same advice. Like, you don't stop.
No wonder you get along.
Yeah, no, I mean,
it's going to be a fair fight life between on the two streets.
So, yeah.
Let's do a podcast, just like a 10-minute segment. I want to talk about Trump with Aaron.
All right. Okay. Sounds great. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening to this edition of Dig Deep on Political Parties, special Trump edition available on the podcast or at our website, kexe.org.
Grab your bag and grab your coat. Tell the ones that need to know. We are headed north. One foot in and one foot back. But it don't pay to live like that. So I cut the ties and I jump the tracks. For never to return.